Hey, this is Chris. I'm back with a new episode, and I am in the studio of artist Amanda Lewin. And we're talking about her art that I just came upon the first time this week. This week would be, last week of June, I guess, at the Sculpture in the City open exhibition in the City of London. And hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Yes, nice to see you again.
Yes, so even though it's called Sculpture in the City, you prefer to call your art artifacts, right? Your pieces.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Why?
Well, it comes from... Actually, I started thinking about this because I went to a talk that the artist Jeremy Deller did last year, and he was talking about the bombed-out car that he toured around the US. Do you know about this
project? No, please don't.
So he took a car that had been destroyed by an IED... in Iraq, and he just toured it from the East Coast to the West Coast, stopping in at various towns in all sorts of, you know, politically lean states that lean in different ways politically.
Okay. Sure, sure. There's a lot of those.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
And it was, and it would just be on a sort of street corner. It wasn't in a gallery or anything. So it was just about having conversations about what this car was and what it meant.
Okay.
And he said that at the end of his tour, and he said it's actually one of his favourite projects, that some really interesting conversations at points he thought he was going to get beaten up, but then he was actually okay. But at the end, he took it to, it was a gallery, like a prominent gallery in Los Angeles, and it was there for a week or a month or something.
Right.
And he actually said that was the worst thing he could have done for it, because once you put it in a gallery space, people start seeing it as a sculpture. In other words, they start looking at it in terms of, you know, the finish is a bit rusty and it's got this twisted form and stuff. And he was like, that's not the point. It's an object. It's an artifact.
Yes.
It tells a story. And now it's got this other story of being toured across the United States. And the project is about that... about those interactions that this object has had, and it's not a sculptural project as such. And I thought that was a really fascinating distinction between objects you make just for sort of aesthetic purposes, which is great, and you know, I appreciate and respect. But what I guess I'm trying to do with my objects is try and find interesting stories to tell and ways that you can manipulate materials and objects to tell those stories.
Okay.
And specifically, I'm interested in telling stories about cities and about places and about landscapes.
Okay. And your object, your commission for your piece for Sculpture in the City is, what is it called? It's called?
A World Wide Web of Somewheres.
A World Wide Web of Somewheres. And it is the somewhere where it is Leadenhall Market.
That's right.
Which is an amazing space.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe your piece there?
So Leadenhall Market is it's one of the oldest markets in London and perhaps in Britain. But the current structure is actually a Victorian building over the site of older markets. My piece is in one of the little alleys in this covered market, and it's hung directly from the trusses and from the sort of the lamppost structures in the market, so it actually fits the building. And it's a hand woven net that is partly inspired by Polynesian fishing nets, which were also maps of wind and sea currents. So this net is also map of subterranean infrastructure underneath the streets of the City of London. But almost more than that, it's also infrastructure plus topography, plus what I describe as superstructure, so political systems and cultural systems in that sort of define our lives in the City of London.
Okay. Are you from London?
Yes.
Okay. And how has your life been defined by being here? The superstructure of this city.
It's hard to identify particular things, I think, because, well, I guess my life here is a product of what UK is, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are from Burma, from Myanmar, which was a former British colony, and which is why, I suppose, they ended up here. And they came to London at a time when London's population was decreasing quite strongly. And and it's amazing, actually, that lots of people forget this, but in the 1980s, London was... Am I allowed to swear? Am I allowed to swear?
Sure.
So London was pretty shit in the 70s and the 80s, and it was experiencing these population declines. And what happened was my parents worked in the NHS, so all those jobs in sort of local services like that, no British people really wanted to do them, and they all went off to like nice sort of suburban or countryside or, you know, small town locations. And so cities which needed, you know, these resources, all those jobs eventually became filled by, you know, people from often former colonial countries.
From the Commonwealth.
Exactly. And I suppose that's one way. I mean, there's so many ways of looking at it, but that's one way, like, systems have influenced my life.
That's fascinating. And it's just... It would be fascinating any time, but just how that applies to the political landscape of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
What I liked about your piece was in Leaden Hall Market. So it's there, and I would imagine if I worked around there and passed it every day, I would have a different thought about it every day or two or so, or as time evolved gradually. Which is nice because it's there for a year, right? The sculpture in the city is a year-long
thing. That's right.
Yeah. And so are you thinking about the viewer when you place that?
Yes. I really, as you say, I really like the fact that it's going to be there a long time. And I particularly like the fact that people might walk past it every day but not really realize exactly what it is.
Because it is kind of just a net hanging
from
the ceiling.
Exactly. And they might think, well, that's an interesting piece of like handicraft or something. But when you actually realize that it's a net that's also a map of London, you sort of, it makes you look at it again, and it starts making you think of there are so many different ways of thinking of it, of ways into it. Such as thinking about it as, you know, where it's located in the market, which is suspended above our heads. So it sort of resembles either a hunter's trap or an acrobat safety net.
Yes.
I have this thing where systems, so the work really is about systems when it comes down to it, and it's about the idea that that lots of people think that systems trap you. It's a very sort of common libertarian trope, both left and right-wing libertarian. But systems also allow you to take chances. They can act as a sort of safety net. So Leaden Hall Market is in the insurance district of London, which is a kind of safety net.
It's the system, the man. I'm being a goof now. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so insurance systems are really interesting because they do allow people to take risks that they wouldn't normally take. I was listening to this really interesting podcast about farmers in Lesotho. And there's a farmer who's doing really well. He grows the best apples in the whole of Southern Africa. And he has the opportunity. He's making good money out of this. And he has the opportunity to expand his farm and continue making this great produce. But he's like, actually, you know what? I'm going to get some goats. And the guy's like, why? Because, you know, goats aren't as profitable as the fruit for him. And he's like, well, it's if there's a poor harvest, you know, the goats the goats are going to survive.
That's his insurance.
Yeah, that's his insurance. Whereas in places where insurance policies are in place, what he would do is buy insurance, and that would, you know, insure him against, you know, weather and all those sorts of risks that come from being a farmer.
Yeah.
And that's what many of the earliest insurance policies come from, is sort of communal policies against things like poor health and... I've got carried away, sorry.
No, please. Yeah, you're reminding me, I recently flew back from Texas to London, and I sat down next to a very nice guy, but also very evangelical in his love of libertarianism and wanted to share that with me on this overnight flight. And it just got to the point, and I think he was trying to convert me or evangelize or something, and he just, and I was just sort of coming back, well, I don't know, I don't think of any ideology as a one-all save-all, you know, I like public schools, so yay socialism, I like efficient government, so yay conservatism, and somewhere in the middle is maybe where I am, sort of thing. And then, but when I said the thing about sort of efficient government, and he did sort of the libertarian rallying cry of like sort of, and small as possible, and I just looked at him, I was like, I don't know. I mean, how long is a string? Mm. And it's that sort of putting form over function.
Yeah, and it's the idea that just small is good, but small and corrupt, what about that? Is that okay? Because it's small, you know?
It's, yeah, I mean, you need what you need, and who gets it right, I don't know. But, you know, some things need to be bigger than others, and... Mm-hmm. I would try to define the function and then build the form around it. I don't know, but maybe I'm on my tangent now. we're lost in our own
fine,
web.
Because, well, I was saying that. So systems act as both. They can be a trap and they can be a sort of safety net, which is what the piece resembles. Is both hunter's trap or safety net, but it could also be cobwebs. Mm. So at what point do systems become cobwebs that, you know, they become anachronistic and, you know, and just old? And the thing about this sort of very hand-woven quality of it is that systems are human-made. We can't treat systems as if they're, I mean, unless you're religious.
Right.
All systems are human-made, right? But there's a tendency to see very old systems as sort of sacred. Oh, it's always been done that way. You know, the way they did it in the past was great and so on, but actually maybe it worked for that time, but why should it work now? You know,
yeah.
So systems need to be changed and maintained and replaced, but they can also be very persistent and robust, and they can sort of have these very long effects that maybe it's not the original system, but it's things that echo it and copy it and things like that. A sort of geographic example of that is the London Wall that goes, which is a Roman wall that went around the city of London. And very few actual fragments of it are left. There's one near the Tower of London.
Oh, yeah.
And there's one near the Barbican.
Yeah, no, right.
And there's actually one,
to,
it's not the London Wall, but there's actually a little bit of Roman wall underneath Leadenhall Market.
Oh, right.
Which is in a barber's. You have to knock and go down and go into the basement, and they've got a bit of old Roman wall. But the thing about the London Wall is that you can still sense its presence. So as you walk along some of the streets like Houndsditch, you're like, is this the edge of the city? Because it feels like an edge.
Right, yeah.
It's not the edge of the city, but you can still feel the presence of the London Wall there.
It defined how the city shaped itself.
Yeah.
Maybe, over
and even when it's sort of been erased, it's in some ways is still there. So... when the Barbican, so when they built the first tubes, they're using a process called cut and cover because they didn't know how to tunnel yet.
Right.
So they would dig a hole, build a tunnel, and cover it over.
Okay.
So those oldest tube tunnels all follow roads, actually. And what happened in the Barbican was like the Barbican was this massive, you know, bomb site after the war. And they decided to rebuild the whole thing as an enormous sort of superstructural estate.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they realigned the road that's now called London Wall, ironically.
Okay,
so that London Wall no longer follows the line of the London Wall.
Oh, wow.
But the tube does, because the tube was
really?
Built before the Barbican.
So what, like the circle line, I guess?
Yeah,
okay.
The metropolitan line.
Okay, so that route from... sort of
Liverpool
Moorgate
Street,
up to King's Cross. I mean, maybe not quite that far, but did that. Okay, that's fascinating. Well, I used to live right on the London Wall, and I think about that. That's fascinating. Wow. Yeah. Well, so Well, this, what you're just saying now about the London Wall and the tube map, but then also, more so, your piece in Leadenhall Market, something, upon first blush, a very simple thing, but with so much complexity of meaning. Is that something that comes from just the way your particular mind ticks, or is that from something from an education in art and your background working as an artist?
I think when you first sort of cotton on to an idea, to use it like a weaving analogy.
That's what I loved about our conversation the other day.
Yeah.
And why I wanted to come back and interview, because it fanned out.
Yeah.
Without just being a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm a mess all the time, so I appreciate the structure, the system you've provided me. Yeah.
Yeah, so when I sort of first thought about it, I was just like, oh. So I was thinking about these Polynesian fishing nets, which were also maps. I was like, oh, it would just be weird.
Well, why were you thinking about Polynesian fishing nets?
It's just something I remember from quite a long time ago. Do you know what? I'm not even sure they actually exist.
Okay.
I sort of remember seeing one about 15 years ago, but then when I was looking up when I started this project, I couldn't actually find any pictures. All I could find were stick maps.
Okay.
But I'd already done my first one, and a friend who's an anthropologist came along to my private view, and I was like, I'm not sure if they exist. And she was like, no, they do exist. Don't worry.
Okay. They're navigational, right?
Yeah.
And reflect sort of constellations.
I thought it was constellations, but actually I think it's wind and sea currents, so actually a type of infrastructure.
Oh, right. Okay.
Natural infrastructure. That they would... the way they would read the currents is actually by lying on the bottom of the boat and letting their body feel which way the boat was going. So it's this very bodily way of, you know, reading the Earth's geography. So when I first thought about it, I was like, that's just pretty cool. But then you start thinking of all these other sort of ways of thinking about it, and I think that's where the richness comes from. For example, suspending it above our heads, sort of horizontally, that brings out all sorts of different associations, which I talked about a little bit. It's completely different to when it's hung on a wall, for example. You just start reading like little sort of snippets of things that kind of feed their way in, such as like, so do you know the difference between a maze and a labyrinth, for example?
If you showed me a picture of a labyrinth, I would say that's a labyrinth. A labyrinth is round, but that's not necessarily the case.
No, so the conceptual difference between a labyrinth and a maze is that a maze you can get lost in. It has dead ends and sort of false turns and all that sort of thing, multiple paths. A labyrinth has one line, and you can find them in churches in particular, and it's about sort of contemplation. And finding one way through focusing your path, if you like. So the reason I brought this up is because a friend was telling me about weaving as a metaphor in sort of ancient Greek myths. And there were absolutely loads of ways of thinking about weaving, and it sort of as storytelling, for example. But the thing I like about the labyrinth thing, so. Is it Theseus who goes into the labyrinth with the Minotaur? So my idea, so it's always described as the labyrinth that Minos and, you know, all these girls and boys get sent down there, and they get lost, and then they get eaten by this bull. But it's described as a labyrinth, right? Whereas conceptually it should be described as a maze.
Okay.
But so my interpretation of this is that the thing that, what's her name? Theseus gets given a ball of string by the girl. It's not Ariadne. It's someone else.
I want to say it. No, I don't. No.
He gets this ball of string, and he uses the string to mark his way from the entrance to wherever he needs to go, and therefore the string is the labyrinth, because there's only one route.
Okay.
That's what transforms it into a labyrinth.
You've left me speechless. well, how does that apply to what you do?
I guess it's this sense of different ways of thinking about string and connections and ties, mm-hmm. and particularly ways of, you know, how individuals weave through.
With that,
I'm giving it, basically,
it might be Ariadne, but
I'm giving you an example of like different ideas that are sort of woven in and can be, mm-hmm. Can be kind of extracted. From the piece, if you wanted to.
Sure.
To unravel it, yeah.
Would that make a netting a layering of labyrinths then?
Could be, yeah.
That's something else. Wow. That's amazing. So what is your background? Where did you study?
I studied architecture at Cambridge.
Okay.
And then I studied urban design at UCL.
Okay.
But then after that, I worked in urban design and architecture a bit, but I've sort of moved away from that, because I suppose I'm more interested in like the stories behind places, and how people connect to the place that they're in. Okay. It's sort of, because I was one of the earliest projects I worked on as an urban designer was the Woodbury Down Master Plan in north of Hackney.
Okay.
And it's, you know, Woodbury Down in the night, it was built in the 50s, and it's built as this sort of utopian housing estate. Mm-hmm. By the 1990s, noughties, it had just descended into sort of a sink estate horror. Like,
right.
You know, it was like real syringes everywhere, and, you know, it's where the council put their least desirable council tenants.
Right.
And what the master plan I was working on as a junior urban designer was, it was basically, you know, tabularized, but it's like knocking everything down and building new things. And the master plan, it had very good intentions, and, you know, it's all things that you could subscribe to completely. It was, sure. There was a high percentage of affordable housing and, you know, social facilities and things like this. But it seemed a shame just to be knocking things down whole scale.
Yeah.
And it's to do with memory and identity and the fact that there wasn't the political will to actually take these buildings and regenerate them and, you know, do things in a more fine-grained kind of way. It was much easier to just knock the whole thing down and start again.
Okay.
And so I started... Because, you know, at the same time, things like the Trellick Tower or the Brunswick,
mm-hmm.
Brunswick Centre, in Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury, yeah.
Those were being regenerated, very different sort of geography.
Yeah, sure.
Of course.
But the
fact was, it was possible to do that, and, you know, and that is to do with, like, basically how people think about places.
Mm-hmm.
As much as it is to do with, you know, economics and all of that. So I suppose that's what started me thinking more about how to change the way that people think about places.
Okay. So was it at that point, were you always pursuing your art, or when you went to university, were you dead set to be a, you know, proper official architect?
So long ago, I can't remember. I know that when I finished, I did work in architecture a bit, but then I started my first project I did as a non-urban designer. Architecture was actually a music festival,
mm-hmm.
and it was a music festival based along the London Overground. Basically, it's a music festival about trains,
okay.
and about infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So the Overground opened in 2011,
mm-hmm.
The East London Line section. And I ran a festival which put musicians both in venues along the Overground and on the trains. And it was kind of celebrating the fact that this new piece of infrastructure just coincidentally happened to link up these places with very strong musical identities. So, like, Dawson has a great jazz scene.
Sure.
Shoreditch has, like, an electric and, you know, mm-hmm. like, nightlife kind of scene. And New Cross had, like, a punk and indie kind of scene. And then... in 2013 it opened to Peckham.
Okay.
And so we did another one in 2013 where we joined up to Peckham as well.
Oh, great. Okay.
And so it was kind of like a like an odyssey, shall we?
Get our
Greek okay. references in. Yes. And so you could go between venues, but when you got on the train, that would also be a kind of stage, and you'd have musicians on those,
those trains as well. Okay. And that started you thinking about place as context and how people interact with place, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then I managed to get myself a commission to do a series with some artists, colleagues of mine. We did a series of installations in a castle down in Dartmoor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a National Trust property, but it's the last castle to be built in the UK, and it has some really interesting stories to be told about it. And so I was doing that more as a sort of creative producer, curator, but we didn't have a lot of budget, so I, you know, ended up making quite a few of the pieces myself, and I was like, I quite enjoy making pieces, actually.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay.
And that's actually when I got back into, you know, making things and thinking about, you know, the process I've just described of, you know, starting with something and then seeing how the ideas sort of fan out and, you know, how to communicate those ideas, if you like.
Fantastic. Wow. So Sculpture in the City is on now. If people want to see your work, they should go to Leadenhall Market and look up.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a year to do so, more or less. If people want to find out more about you, how can they do that online, or how can they get in touch?
My website is placesandthings.org.uk.
.org.uk, yep. Places and Things.
That's right. .org.uk. And I'm also on Instagram.
Okay.
It's places.n.things.
Okay.
On Instagram.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And your surname is Lwin.
That's right.
Amanda Lwin.
Yep.
Okay. Anything else?
I don't think so.
Well, thank you for very, very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me into your studio. All right, thanks.
Great.